SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour three at the races on this increasingly wet Tuesday. Happy to get an opportunity to talk to you, Robertson. And, of course, last Monday evening, the terrific, the latest terrific performance by Hot Shot Anna that goes back and forth between you and Mac. And, Mac, the move to the synthetic has really been a particular tonic for her. Congratulations on what's been a terrific run with Hot Shot Anna.
Well, thank you very much.
You know, when Casey called you and you know, the, I know that you said, well, you're probably calling about the, you know, about the filly. I'm equally eager to talk to you about Samilla's Sense of Snow, because Marcus Hirsch and I had a terrific smile over her. And I'm assuming you were a fan of the book, and I got a big kick out of the fact that 30 years later, Samilla has a horse named after her.
Well, actually, I never read the book. I saw the movie.
But all right, that's all right.
I liked the movie. I wanted to name a horse after that movie.
That is great. Well, the book is wonderful. Marcus said that, you know, that you have a very esoteric background and interests, and I thought it was great that you got and I tell you, she ran terrific. That was a nice debut.
Well, at this stage in her career, she's a better filly than Anna was, but whether she continues to develop and who knows and stays sound, that's always a matter of wait and see. But she's a nice big. She's a much bigger, more imposing filly than Anna is. Anna's small and just runs her guts out. But Smilla's done everything we've asked of her, so I hope she continues to develop. But if she doesn't, she doesn't.
You know, your work with Mac, explain how the schedule, how a year goes along in terms of you guys, you know, working your horses and passing them between you.
Well, it just depends wherever the right spot is for the horses. You know, if I'm in a place and I've got a horse that there's nothing coming up for it, I let Mac look for a race and wherever he is, and we just switch them back and forth. Mac has the majority of the horses because Mac is 40 years old and I'm approaching 70. So he can handle a lot bigger string of horses. I try not to have more than 30 at one spot, while Mac will have 70 or 80, you know, at different times. But occasionally I've got more horses. Like right now, I've got quite a few here because we're kind of consolidating them all here in Chicago until Mac's going to go to Keeneland, and then in November I'll go down to Fairgrounds, and he'll go to Keeneland and then to Hot Springs, I assume. But so just depends upon the time of the year, what we have going, and who needs to run, and we switch them back and forth.
Well, you both do just a tremendous job, and you know, one of the names that horse players and really everybody on the backstretches that you both participate so widely respected, and for you to have this filly a trap shot out of Holy Bull Mare and a modest. In a modest purchase, and she just continues to evolve and improve. And this string of synthetic starts, the Chicago Handicap, then the two races at Presque Isle, talk about you know, what you see from her. You told Casey earlier that you won't go to Breeders' Cup with her.
No, in fact, I have already turned her out. She's going to get a little R&R because a horse can only do so much. And since I own her myself, nobody's giving me any pressure to do anything with her. And how much can you expect of these horses, you know, in 1 year? So she's going to get some rest. I think she deserves it. It's not a soundness issue. She's still sound and, you know, training good. And they don't run, you know, they run the Breeders' Cup on the dirt. And I think that's probably her least favorite surface. So, I mean, she's won on the dirt and run good races. But I think Poly Track's her best. Turf is probably next. And dirt, she's not quite the same filly. And though she's really good right now, maybe she'd go there and surprise me. I don't know. But we're not going to do it. We're going to give her, and I think she's earned a rest, so she's going to get it.
Well, and there's people listening, you that absolutely will just totally respect and understand, you know, this approach. I mean, she was a $20,000 Keeneland yearling. Talk about, you know, how you're at this stage of your career, and you mentioned, you know, you're 70, and you've had.
Well, I'm not 70. I'm 67. But I'm
okay. you snuck in a few years you rounded yourself off.
Right. I feel like I'm 70 a lot of times.
Yeah, I love it. Well, talk about your background, because you came, I think, from, I want to say, Penn National.
Well, no, I came from Nebraska.
Nebraska.
That's where
right.
I still live. I was in college in Nebraska, and I decided to take a semester off to go to the racetrack and work, because I always liked racehorses, and I just never went back to school. I was in college. I was going to become a lawyer. I decided to go into an honest profession instead of become a horse trainer.
I love it. I love it. I mean, how'd you get on in terms of getting into the game and you know, beginning?
I just went to work for a guy that just recently died, old Bob Lee, Robert E. Lee in Nebraska. He was always the head of the president of the HBPA and had a lot of horses. He lived in a town not too far from where I lived. I just went to work for him and went to the racetrack.
Unbelievable. And then just in terms of circuits and the way things evolved, and obviously what, Exarban, and from there?
Well, Winter. Yeah, I went to Exarban, and then I went to Penn National. It's been 10 years at Penn National.
That's where,
and then
okay.
I came back to Illinois, and I came up with a good horse, a lucky. We had a horse named Polar Expedition.
Sure.
Just a little tiny horse, and bred like he should have been worth $1,000, and probably should have been, and he made almost $1.5 million. He was a good horse, and that kind of got me going a little bit more, where I started picking up more horses, and then having my son, you know, with the youthful and enthusiasm, has gotten us a lot of clients too, where, you know, people want somebody young involved with their horses generally. And so I think Mac has helped us a lot. And Mac, really, with this filly, she started getting real good for Mac. The last race she ran at Canterbury was a really good race. And she ran a good number on the sheets. And though I'm not a proponent of the sheets, but she looked like she was going in the right direction the last time she ran up there, and that was on the dirt. And then I was just shipping her up to Canterbury generally and running her. I had her here, and she always trained great on the poly track, but I actually ran her down here, her first out in her life, and she didn't run too well, but it was her first out, and she had a rough trip, and I kind of got to thinking she didn't like the poly track when I was obviously wrong.
You mentioned Polar Expedition, and Polar Expedition had a glorious career. Raced forever, that horse.
He won stakes 6 years in a row. From 2 to 7, he never missed a year without winning a stake. He was a good horse.
Just looking, won at two, won the Arlington Washington Futurity, followed it up with the Breeders' Futurity, then came back as a three-year-old, the Old Mountain Valley at Oaklawn, then won the Jim Beam when it was really the Jim Beam. Didn't run great in the Illinois Derby and kind of...
caught an awful sloppy track. Hit himself out of the gate, really hit the side of the gate when he broke that day. The track was, it had been raining. I kicked myself for running him that day on that track. Lucky he didn't break his leg off, because it was a bad, treacherous track. But how do you scratch a 3-to-5 shot in a $500,000 race?
Absolutely.
But I should have. In retrospect, I should have scratched him that day.
Kurt Bork was his early rider.
Yeah, Kurt rode him. I just saw Kurt at the sales the other day down in Kentucky. I think he's running a farm down in Louisiana and pinhooking horses now.
Nice. Well, you look through the career. You took advantage with Polar Expedition of his Illinois breeding, but he also won the Washington Park Handicap when it was a Grade Two. On and on and on. What a nice horse he was. How about that? And then he came back and he won the Jockey Club at Sportsman's right before you retired him.
Yeah. We had to put him down last year. I think he was 26 years old.
Wow. Mark Guidry rode him at the end. That last win.
He was strictly a speed horse. As he got older, I think he was a smart enough horse to realize he couldn't go to the front anymore. He learned to come from behind.
Unbelievable. He was by Kodiak.
Yeah. Not a very good stud.
but you and Jim Cody had a lot of fun, boy, did you?
Yeah, we did.
I love it. Well, just happy for you to have this kind of a filly, and you'll bring her back as a mare next year. You mentioned the summer at Arlington. The season wrapped up this past week, and you've had the chance to see the things, the ups and downs in the Midwest, and of course, the loss of high-level racing in Arkansas, not in Arkansas, but in Nebraska, really sad, because I lived in Kansas City in the 80s and would go up to Exarban, and it was a wonderful, at one time, seventh, eighth largest handle track in the country.
And nothing for them to have 25, 30,000 people at the race on a Saturday.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a great track.
And that doesn't make it, when you think back to it too, when you see, at Lincoln they run and at Fawner, and the people still love it. And you got so many great horsemen, of course, came out of Nebraska as well.
Yeah. Nebraska, they had a lot of horsemen came out of there. And Johnny Merritt was from Western Nebraska, I believe.
Yep.
And then you had Vanberg and Harvey Veneer. A lot of people came out of Nebraska.
Well, your name and your family absolutely adding to that, and Mac's success, and we'll look forward to Hotshot Anna coming back as a five-year-old. And you, I'm delighted. Mac's been on with us, but this is my first chance to talk to you, and I'm thrilled.
Okay, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. You, Robertson, everybody, and the elder training Robertson, son Mac, and Hotshot Anna, no Breeders' Cup, and that's the way you do it old school. You have a great season, as they've had with her, and now freshen her up and bring her back as a five-year-old mare. Tremendous. This was her fourth win in seven starts on the year, and she banked about 400 and change on the season. So, hot shot, Anna. Tremendous. You, Robertson. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We got Dick Powell to join us and John White before we wrap up on this wet Tuesday at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Pennsylvania's breeding program is truly the most lucrative in North America. Now, we'll pay a 50% breeder award for PA-sired, PA-bred maidens who run first, second, or third, with 25% for non-PA-sired PA-breds. Last year, the number of mares bred rose by 15% in Pennsylvania. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
Hi, John Pirana here, inviting you to join me in the Dublin Racing Club, along with friends like Steve Bick and Tom Durkin. If you have an interest in Ireland and horse racing, it's the best way to be involved with both. So log on now to DublinRacingClub.com and come join us at one of Ireland's 26 racetracks.
The Dublin Racing Club is designed to introduce racing fans to the ownership experience by participating in the sport in Ireland. For more information on the Dublin Racing Club, log on to DublinRacingClub.com.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Broken mornings, broken nights, and broken days in between. Open ground, the sky is open, makes an open scene. Oh, oh. Just like in fiction, in every addiction.
We're back at the races. Coming back with Aurora there, Conqueror, which I happen to really like. Due for a follow-up to that. We're due for a visit and a follow-up to the Robertson conversation with Dick Powell. And don't know if it, I don't know if it's, if it was news or not. I didn't see anywhere that E. Robertson had been quoted before today that that Hotshot Anna would not go on to the Breeders' Cup. So the opportunity for a Presque Isle Downs Masters winner to succeed in the Breeders' Cup, at least the winner anyway, they're there are other candidates that were behind Hotshot Anna, Let It Ride Mom, and Crazy Sweet. And I suppose it'd be interesting to see what Suge does with Browse, because she did not start well. And with a better start, Browse might have been more involved. So there might be horses yet coming out of the Masters. Dick, I don't know if you had a chance to hear Hugh Robertson, but I was just delighted to get him on. I've had his son Mac on before, but that's our first conversation with the veteran horseman.
Luckily, you had him on before me, because I would have come on and talk about Hotshot Anna and her great shot at the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint, and then he comes on and says, before I was able to talk about it, that he is going to rest her up and just give her time off for next year. Smart move, and nothing wrong with doing that. And that was interesting. Yeah, no, that was, and I'm sure it was newsworthy, because I hadn't seen anything about that. I would have.
No, I hadn't either.
That would have caught my eye. So, yes,
I agree.
Broke some news this morning. I also listened earlier when you were talking to Andy about the Cotillion. And I wrote a column today for Twin Spires, the blog. And I don't know if I mentioned to you. Did I mention to you that I went to the University of Louisville this summer and spoke to their steward school?
Maybe. I mean, we may have touched on it on a separate. Yeah, maybe on a separate. Now that you say that, I remember.
One of my big issues with them, and they were not happy. I was lucky to get out of there alive. They weren't happy with what I had to say. And one of my big issues was optics matter. And that if you don't blink the horse, you cannot leave it up to the riders to claim foul. Well, sure enough, Saturday, there was no steward's inquiry in the Cotillion. When I'm sitting there watching and waiting and waiting and waiting, and Mike filed an objection. But where were the stewards? How do you not take a look at that? When the leader is weaving in and out, and I compared it to Dale Earnhardt Sr., you know, keeping Jeff Gordon that day. You know, you're in front, and you're kind of taking away the inside, then you're taking away the outside, and whether it was a foul or not at that point, there clearly should have been an inquiry, which I have no idea why they did not post an inquiry. Yes, there was an objection. Yes, they did view it from all different angles. And yes, in my mind, they did make the right call by taking Giroux down. But how do you not flash the inquiry sign? I mean, right in the beginning, not 5-10 minutes later while the horses are coming back. So that's one of the things that just drives me nuts, that besides making the correct call, you pretty, which is a variable, the constant should be the process. And the process should have been, yeah, we got to look at this, because everyone else is looking at it. We're all sitting there watching the race, and we're looking at it. And clearly something happened. We don't have the angles with the pan shot that we eventually get when they post an inquiry, and then we get to see the head on and the back on and the pan and all that, and then try to judge whether she was far enough in front to do what she did, which sometimes you can. But in this case, they took her down. But it was just how there was no steward's inquiry in that race is beyond me, and that's what drives people like me and others just absolutely crazy when it comes to these decisions, because it just adds another layer to the controversy.
Well, and Tony Black will flesh this out more. We've had this conversation on a different occasion regarding the way the stewards handle and these opportunities. And Tony says they do not inquire. Very rarely, he said, will they slap on the light? And it makes it even more remarkable that they had the fortitude to take Monomoy Girl down in that setting, because there were plenty of people to say, well, in grade ones there's more leeway, and that, which I don't get at all, and well, John White can address this next, but I don't buy that side of things, you know, that, oh, well, it's a grade one, so they're hesitant to take. What do you mean they're hesitant to take action? How is that any different? Why does this make it in the World Series? Do they change the strike zone? Is the neighborhood play? I don't get that rationale. It makes no sense. But you know, it became, I mean, it was pretty obvious even on the pan what was going on. I mean, you could see that. And you know, the other part of this that, you know, the people that are still defending that Monomoy Girl should have, or positing that Monomoy Girl should have stayed up. Laurent Giroux himself said that he was doing it to basically, you know, do the best he could to keep Midnight Bizou from getting by, that she otherwise she would have gone right on by. I give him credit for putting it in the hands of the stewards, actually, and hoping that he would stay up, because obviously there was a real chance that he was going to stay up.
Well, and I give the credit to Mike for filing the claim, because if Mike doesn't file a claim, Giroux wins the race.
Right. That's right. That too.
Now, here's the other complicating factor, which I brought up at steward school. It's more imperative than ever for the stewards to blink the light because of all these conflicts with owners. Monomoy Girl was partially owned by Monomoy Stables. Midnight Beast was partially owned by Madicat Stable. Madicat Stable and Monomoy Stables are both Sal Kumin. Sal Kumin seems to own a piece of every major horse in America. So you, as a rider, you want to be the one to have him lose his fifth straight grade one stakes. Not that it's going to cost him the Eclipse Award, but that shouldn't even be in the thinking. And yet, I think it is. And especially with the super trainers and now the super partnerships, that it's more imperative than ever for stewards to be proactive and give us, the bettors, a level of confidence that you're looking at it, and you, the third-party objective, representing the betting and the rules and doing things correctly, are on the job. But if you don't blink the light, and I know you're looking at it. Every steward will tell you, oh, don't worry, we're looking at it. Yeah, but you're looking at it, but we're not looking at what you're looking at, because we're not getting all these replay angles that you're looking at, and which we're making decisions and, you know, we tend to be conspiratorial. You know, horse players get a little wacky sometimes. just blink the damn light.
Yes. Yes. Well, let's light the lamp on Presque Isle for the week. And I just put up a tweet with the news officially from Hugh Robertson, so that can go circulate out into the Twitterverse. Winding down, Dick, 2 weeks left.
Couple of nights today, three nights this week. Excuse me, today's Tuesday. We got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then Sunday through Thursday next week. So we have 8 days of racing left. The trainer race is as kind of dominant as Saratoga was. Teresa Connolly has 58 winners. Jerry Brooks has 38. So I went back in last year and looked at Jerry Brooks won last year 50, Teresa had 43. The year before, 2016, Teresa had 42, and Ron Potts had 33. Brooks only had 23. So Teresa lost last year. She's come back with a vengeance and has really, really dominated. The rider race is pretty interesting because Pablo Morales rides virtually every day at Presque Isle. He's the dominant rider there, and he has 134 wins. Gallardo's been riding more than last year when he split his time up more away from Presque Isle than before. Gallardo has 93 wins, but he doesn't ride 5 days a week. He rides mom at different tracks in the East Coast. But the year before, in 2016, Gallardo had 148 wins. Morales had 102. That's the two of them going against each other 5 days a week. So now it's not Morales against Gallardo. It's Morales against the 2016 version of Gallardo. So with 8 days of racing left, can Morales win 14 races and tie Gallardo's 148 wins in 2016? It's a couple of days. The problem is we only run 8 races a day, so it's not like we're running 11 or 12.
Right.
And you can pick up a couple. But that'll be fun to watch. I'm sure Morales will get over 140, and then it's a matter of how close he can get to Gallardo's 148. But when you consider 100 race days, basically 8 races a day. We've had a couple of days when we ran 9. Let's say 800 races, which doesn't sound like a lot, but Saratoga runs 400. It's just that the meet is spread out more. So you got 800 races, and you got 2 riders that account every year for well over 200 of the wins. So those 2 riders continue to do well. This year it's been Morales. Last year was Morales. The year before was Gallardo. Teresa Connolly, 58 wins and only 80-something days of racing. That's big-time performance. So she's had a great meet. And as we've talked about the other guys, Potts and Glenn Wismer and the riders, Ariel Ayala and Scott Speed, they've all had terrific meets. And that seems to be where the money is with the go below the top 2 guys. And then that's where the pickings, at least pari-mutuel, seem to be a little bit better. I'm assuming tonight, Steve, that the track is going to be Speed favoring. There's been rain out in the Erie, Pennsylvania mm-hmm. area, and that will tighten up any track. And it does tighten up a synthetic track, and also not much sunlight. So race number 2, I do like the favorite number 4, Napolito from Matt Kintz, and Matt has a huge lead, 28% winners. And he's been consistently right around 30% for the whole meet. So he's had a big, big meet. He gets Gallardo back. Is a pace prompter, not a stone cold speed horse, but a pace prompter, and I think Gallardo will get this one up involved early from post 4 and then use its seeming class edge to get home. And in race number 6, we're going to go with number 5, Alexandra Kay. And she, if I can find her, is very, very fast. Couldn't hang on 2 back when she raced against Money Allowance foes. In a turf sprint at Saratoga behind Dream Passage. But then she went back to Presque Isle and went wire to wire, held on by a neck with none other than Jose Ortiz in the Irons. That was September 17th. That was the night of the Masters. And then Alexandra Kay will be ridden tonight by Ariel Ayala, who's done a lot of work at this meet for Kevin Rice. So those are 2 plays for tonight. When you're looking at the racing in the next 8 days, you're going to see horses out of class. There's only 8 days of racing. There's only 64 races left. So you're seeing trainers put horses in virtually any spot that they can find. So my rule is if it's a 10 claim, I'm moving up to allowance. If the 10 claim is in good form, I'm going with the 10 claimer. I'm not going to get turned off by the alleged move up in class because there's just not enough spots to fill for these horses. So the trainers are just looking to find spots to jump into in the next 8 days of racing. So keep that in mind when handicapping these races. I think recent form trumps class.
I've got one question that has come in from a listener. Listener Ron wants to know, who's the leading owner at Presque Isle this year?
Boy, that's a real good question.
I'm going to answer it for you. It's obviously listener Ron. Ron Paolucci. Luch Racing.
The minute you said it, I'm thinking, now let me see. Luch has had a bunch of different trainers. So he's had Jeff Radosovich, and he's had
Radosovich,
and he's had a couple others. I'm drawing blanks naturally. Yeah, good for him.
So good job, Ronnie.
I think he has horses over in Ohio, so it's easy for them to go back and forth.
Well, he's the king of Ohio racing. He's a human little brown jug. Which, by the way,
did anyone watch the Little Brown Jug last
night? I
just as good a race as you'll ever watch.
What, five of them at the wire?
Yes. And the winner had no chance of winning. If they had in-race betting, when they go down the backstretch the second time, he's almost dropping back. Dave Miller's tapping him with the whip. He's not getting much of a response. And then in the stretch, there was a 26 and change third quarter off a 54 and change half. So Montrell Teague's horse, who was game as could be, just couldn't keep that pace up. And here comes Dave Miller for his fifth Little Brown Jug win and five horses across the track. It was the 20th race of the day. It went off almost at 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
Crazy. I wound up watching it. It was great.
We had so much fun when we were a 4 o'clock show, 4 to 7. We did the afternoons. The first, I don't know, that was almost, let's see, I think in 2000, Casey, when did we move? 2010, 11? I noted the anniversary a couple of months ago. But one of my favorite days, and even though we were, you know, we've never really had, you know, we've talked occasionally about harness, but that was one of my favorite days. We would play the qualifiers and the final of the jug, and it was really the atmosphere there is remarkable. It exudes through the TV. I mean, the jug, it's amazing.
Yeah, I was watching them that afternoon, and I had to take Gavin to baseball practice, so I came back, and it still hadn't been run. I did watch the qualifying races, and in fact, the winner broke stride in his heat.
Right,
coming to the gate, he goes off stride, and then he makes this monster move to get back into it late in the race, and that's what enabled him to qualify for the final. And they even disqualified a horse in the first heat for cutting off the second horse going into the turn at the quarter pole. But he finished in the top four. He was placed fourth, so he made it into the final despite being DQ'd in his heat. So it was a very, very eventful Little Brown Jug, very exciting, and just you know, it's kind of Americana. It's kind of...
Oh, no, not kind of. It is. It's pure. It's as pure a throwback to a certain kind. There's so many things that are going on at the jug that make it special, and that includes the county fair aspect, the great heritage of standardbred racing, particularly in Ohio, and the padlocking of your chair to the fence, and it's as pure as it gets. I love it.
Oh, I enjoyed watching. That was a lot of fun.
Well, we're going to stay right here, Dick, and rather than take a break, I don't want to run out of time and shortchange John White, but we'll say good luck to everybody playing Presk tonight, and one of your options, 5:30, and more with Dick next week. It's been a very productive season covering Presque Isle Downs, and you can get Dick's analysis at their website, Presque Isle Downs. And we'll stay here because John White's standing by, and it's always... an opportunity when John joins us, given his heritage among all the things he's done in racing, of being a steward. We're going to get his answer to the cotillion and how he saw it and how it might be adjudicated elsewhere and how the park stewards saw it. John, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I certainly will comment on that, but more importantly, did you find the kitty?
The kitty was curled up and asleep on an old chair in my outer office, and he is quite content. He's going to have to discuss it with Tina when she gets home, whether he's going to continue to be allowed to come up here. But that'll be up to her. But he's okay. Yeah. He was hiding. He was curled up in a chair.
I think Dick Powell put it well, and as have many others. You know, you said that Tony Black has said that how did you say that Tony Black says it in terms of the stewards and the inquiry sign at parks?
No, they're very judicious in terms of turning the light on. They're not inquisitive.
Well, unless you have a policy to never put it up, I don't see how you could not put it up in this race. I mean, if you ever put it up, it should have been put up in a grade one race with Monomoy Girl coming in and then drifting clear out to the middle of the racetrack. I mean, it's just pretty ridiculous, really, and it really just doesn't look good. I mean, I hate to be critical of fellow stewards, I mean, because it's a tough job. Nobody knows that more than me, but whatever they would be reluctant to do that or why they don't do that, and that, apparently that was also an issue this year at Emerald Downs. Joe Withey was telling me that up there, that it's kind of the same thing, that the stewards, as almost a general policy, wait for the rider to claim foul. And it's just, I don't think that that is the way to proceed. I think that the stewards, unfortunately, when I've been a steward in Washington, Idaho, and California, this year I've worked as a steward at Golden Gate, and also for a night at Los Alamitos, the quarter horses. At Los Alamitos, earlier this month, we had a race where the number five, there were seven horses in the race, and the five came in leaving the gate, and people say, well, you never take horses down leaving the gate. Well, the five came in leaving the gate, made contact with the fours, instigating a chain reaction in which the path of the three horse was taken because the three broke slow, but the three had to steady, and the two and the one were compromised. They were bumped and impeded, and we took down the five and put it below the lowest finishing horse of the one, two, three, and four. The four won the race despite the bump. And but the owners of the four, of the five, I should say, that we disqualified, I got a call from them later in the card at Los Alamitos, and the owner said that he's been in racing for 40 years, and I said, well, so have I. And he said that, that's the worst call I've seen in 40 years. And I said, well, we'll just have to disagree on that. And I feel very comfortable with the call we made. But my point on that is we had the inquiry sign up immediately. I mean, for just within seconds after they crossed the finish line, there was an incident that we knew we would be looking at in terms of a possible disqualification. And so the inquiry sign up went up right away. And that is really the most troubling thing about the cotillion to me, is that I just don't understand it. And Dick Powell also brought up the point, if you've got common ownerships, and, you know, you don't want to put the burden on the jockeys. You know, the jockeys have to interact all the time, and you get trainers and so forth involved. And, I mean, you shouldn't pass the buck to the participants. You as a racing official, as a steward, should be not even hesitant to put up that inquiry sign when you see something that you feel merits an inquiry sign. And look, when I used to sit there on the set at HRTV for all those years and watched races all over the country, I mean, and this is the thing about the people at home, they're sitting there. You're a veteran watcher, Steve. Most of the time, you know when there's likely going to be an inquiry. I mean, we're not always going to know that, but I mean, if you've been watching races for years, you know that there's a pretty good chance there's going to be an inquiry into the race. And again, why put the burden on the jockey to have to claim foul, or an owner or trainer who also could claim foul? So, and as far as the decision itself, you know, Keith Jones, in his explanation afterwards, I thought made a good point on behalf of the stewards, in that the disqualification was made because, and this is what the explanation was, that Midnight Bazoo was denied the opportunity to run a straight path. And that's right. Kind of sums it up pretty well, really, when you come to think of it. And it goes back to what Andy Serling was saying earlier, and what you have said many times. I mean, you don't need contact for a disqualification. this contact will make a call easier, but it doesn't. It's not the end all and be all to make a disqualification. You don't have to have contact. You can cut somebody off and be disqualified without making contact with them. So that's another one of those that for some reason through the years people have gotten it in their head that unless there's any contact, you're not going to have a number taken down, and that's just not the case. So, you know, I feel for the connections of Monomoy Girl because she's, I've grown to really respect her so much. And, you know, under the context of the race, you know, to make that early move and race on the terrible part of the track for so much of the race and to get to that finish line first, you know, really shows what a quality filly she is. On the other hand, Midnight Bazoo, you know, I'm with you, Steve. I think there's every possibility, if not probability, but at least we could go as far as say possibility, that if Bonamoy Girl maintains a straight course, that Midnight Bazoo would have won the race. I will say this, and this is something I've brought up to jockeys. You know, you bring in the jockeys the next morning in terms of going over the films with them and then determining whether there will be a sanction for a disqualification or even if there's not a disqualification. And what I have told these riders going back clear to when I was a steward for the first time in 1979, the more you can possibly stay straight on that racetrack, the less trouble you're going to be in. And when you don't stay straight, you're risking having your number taken down. I mean, the minute you do not stay straight, you know, you're placing yourself into that position. Now, just because you don't stay straight doesn't mean you're always going to be taken down. In most cases, you won't. But, you know, in the case of Monomoy Girl, she would have been very fortunate if her number hadn't come down. So, and I think you're right. I think Giroux was taking his best shot. I mean, I know, I think, like John DeSantis said, that the fuel tank was on E, and he knew that, and he was doing his best to win the race. And that's something Andy Serling articulated that is absolutely right. You want these riders to do what they can do within the rules, though, to win the race. And the problem is, you've got to do it within the rules. So, for me, I mean, it's just a shame when you get such a major race, a million-dollar race like that, and, you know, it has to be tarnished by this. I mean, that they just couldn't run around there, and either Monomoy Girl wins the race fair and square, or Midnight Bazoo, you know, beats her without Monomoy Girl running all over the place, so...
The one thing I asked, and I discussed it at the time with Johnny, when Giroux dropped down and was trying to force Mike Smith to the rail, to the perceived dead rail at Philly, if he had just done that, and even if he had tightened up even further, once he gets by and is clear, he has every right to, you know, to move down toward the rail, and if he wants to tighten up a little bit, that I think that would have been one thing. And if Smith doesn't get the opportunity, or if there's isn't room to get by and so forth at that point, and Monomoy Girl powers home to the wire and wins, I don't think if there's an inquiry on that first incident, the beginning, the origins of it, I think she stays up. The egregious portion was going out to meet her and just hurting her for literally the rest of the stretch. That's where this became just an absolute slam dunk. So that was that portion. Got about 3-4 minutes, John. Why don't you riff on? And I appreciate, you know, your seasoned steward eye on that. Let's talk about McKenzie's comeback and your impressions of what we saw and what it foretells. You know, looking toward the Breeders' Cup for him and for everybody that was behind him.
Well, I think Andy Serling used a good word to describe it. It was terrific. And I'm certainly pleased because when I was in Las Vegas on August 2nd, I put a few dollars on him for the Breeders' Cup future book at the Wynn Hotel at 30-1. So Certainly, I feel that I loved it when Andy Serling was calling him, you'd have to consider him a major player, because I like having a major player at 30-1. That doesn't happen very often in this game, but I've got to get him in the starting gate for the race, because Bob, you know, will determine whether he's ready for that or whether he'll await the Clark. So for me, I'm certainly crossing my fingers and hoping the Breeders' Cup Classic will be in the cards and they don't await the Clark. But in any case, I'm a fan of the horse, and, you know, that 107 buyer says so much about him, you know, off the layoff. But I think something else this really points out is that I think sometimes we just take Bob Baffert and his training ability for granted. I mean, because he's done so much. But, I mean, think of what he's done just this year. I mean, he wins the Triple Crown with a horse that didn't run as a two-year-old. That's never been done before. You know, just with Justified to win the Santa Anita Derby in his third career start. I mean, how often do you see a horse win a major race like the Santa Anita Derby with somebody in their third career start? And then here, for some icing on the cake, you have McKenzie, who hadn't run since March, being able to win a Grade 1 million-dollar race at a mile and an eighth off that layoff and defeating, you know, it wasn't the strongest field ever, but it's a good field. I mean, when you've got Hotberg and Bravazo and Instilled Regard and, you know, horses like that in there, I mean, this was not a weak field by any stretch. And that's just a race that McKenzie can really use as a building block to build from going forward. You know, Mike Smith said after the race he feels like he was probably about 85%. And so, I mean, if you get maybe a 90, 95, 100% McKenzie in the Breeders' Cup, he could be certainly a major player in there. But, you know, I'm impressed by, you know, Bob Baffert focuses on the Kentucky Derby and the Triple Crown, and understandably, because that's so important for our game and so important for him, for any trainer. But I've been impressed with Bob's, what he's been able to accomplish with horses that missed the Triple Crown. Think of that, of the million-dollar or richer races he's been able to win during the second half of the year with three-year-olds that missed the Triple Crown, like Bayern, like Arrogate, like West Coast, and now McKenzie. All four of those horses did not run in any of the Triple Crown races and yet came back during the second half of the season and won races worth $1 million or more. And to me, that really says a lot about Bob, because he's had so much success in the Triple Crown. I mean, he's won more Triple Crown races than anybody, 15. And he's tied with Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons to be the only trainer to win two Triple Crowns. So, I mean, he focuses on that Triple Crown, but it isn't like that's the only thing Bob can do. As I say, look what he's done with these horses that don't even run in the Triple Crown, right? These three-year-olds, that, and what they've been able to achieve during the second half of the year. To me, it's just yet another illustration of what a tremendous trainer Bob Baffert is.
No doubt, and had literally one opportunity left to get a route Grade 1 for McKenzie before, you know, before the, you know, the season ends. There is the Malibu on December 26th, but it's one turn. This was the last Grade 1 chance, and perfect execution by Baffert. So we'll look forward to this weekend, John, and racing resuming on Friday at Santa Anita. So we'll be watching for analysis at santaanitapark.com, and we will talk to you next week, and we're going to start to accrue our lists for Breeders' Cup, start to get focused in, but a nice few weeks ahead for the Santa Anita autumn season. So we'll talk to you next
week. Yeah, they're drawing entries this morning, even as we speak, for that opening day Friday card. So we'll get things kicked off on Friday. And, of course, the big card will be Saturday with the multiple Grade 1 races with so much in terms of Breeders' Cup ramifications. So certainly, as usual, that autumn meet at Santa Anita is going to get off with a big bang. But the big news this morning is you found the kitty.
Very big. And no Hotshot Anna in the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint. Those were today's breaking stories. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Steve.
John White, everybody. Post time, John. And I'm sure John will be playing the Stronach Group Magna 5 Want to thank Pat Kelly and Hugh Robertson. You want to talk about Veteran Horseman Tuesday, we'll call it. That was fun. Dick Powell, John White, and Andy. It's a Tuesday, so you know that you got partially a little bit of a limited schedule today, but that includes Presque Isle and Finger Lakes and Fort Erie, Indiana Grand, Louisiana Downs, Mountaineer, Parks, Thistledown, and Zia. There you go. Good luck if you're playing. Back with you tomorrow, Wednesday, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale, the home of good magic. We'll talk to Sid tomorrow. Norm McKnight is going to join us tomorrow. Looking forward to that. I've been wanting to get a Norm visit in. And so much more. Pete Fornital and Seth Merrow, and we'll find a bunch of other things to do midweek. At the Races, Sirius XM. Talk to you in the morning. Thanks, everybody.
You're checking out the honey, baby. Had to go killing all the bees.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Pennsylvania's breeding program is truly the most lucrative in North America. Now, we'll pay a 50% breeder award for PA-sired, PA-bred maidens who run first, second, or third, with 25% for non-PA-sired, PA-breds. Last year, the number of mares bred rose by 15% in Pennsylvania. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
Hi, John Parada here, inviting you to join me in the Dublin Racing Club, along with friends like Steve Bick and Tom Durkin. If you have an interest in Ireland and horse racing, it's the best way to be involved with both. So log on now to DublinRacingClub.com and come join us at one of Ireland's 26 racetracks.
The Dublin Racing Club is designed to introduce racing fans to the ownership experience by participating in the sport in Ireland. For more information on the Dublin Racing Club, log on to DublinRacingClub.com.